1 through to chapter 6, verse 12. Or I may even add 13. But it's difficult to know how to split this up. So it's a story which all hangs together. Just remember that at the end of chapter 4, Moses with Aaron have come to the elders of Israel, have shown them the signs that God has given them to prove that he's with them, and they bowed down and worshipped God because they believed. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go, so that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness." Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let us take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to your work." Then Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now numerous, and you are stopping them from working." That same day, Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and overseers in charge of the people: "You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw. But require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They are lazy. That is why they are crying out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Make the work harder for the people so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies." Then the slave drivers and the overseers went out and said to the people, "This is what Pharaoh says: I will not give you any more straw. Go and get your own straw wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced at all." So the people scattered all over Egypt to gather stubble for use for straw. The slave drivers kept pressing them, saying, "Complete the work required of you for each day, just as when you had straw." And Pharaoh's slave drivers beat the Israelite overseers they had appointed, demanding, "Why haven't you met your quota of bricks yesterday or today as before?" And then the Israelite overseers went and appealed to Pharaoh, "Why have you treated your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet we are told, 'Make bricks.' Your servants are being beaten, but the fault is with your own people." Pharaoh said, "Lazy, that's what you are, lazy. That is why you keep saying, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Now get to work. You will not be given any straw, yet you must produce your full quota of bricks." The Israelite overseers realized they were in trouble when they were told, "You are not to reduce the number of bricks required of you for each day." And when they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them, and they said, "May the Lord look on you and judge you. You have made us obnoxious to Pharaoh and his officials, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Why, Lord? Why have you brought trouble on this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has brought trouble on this people, and you have not rescued your people at all." And then the Lord said to Moses, "Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of his country." God also said to Moses, "I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan where they resided as foreigners. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord." Moses reported this to the Israelites, but they did not listen to him because of their discouragement and harsh labor. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites go out of this country." But Moses said to the Lord, "If the Israelites will not listen to me, why would Pharaoh listen to me, since I speak with faltering lips?" Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron about the Israelites and Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he commanded them to bring the Israelites out of Egypt. North Korea, Afghanistan, Somalia, Sudan, Pakistan, Eritrea, Libya, Iraq, Yemen, Iran, India, Saudi Arabia, the Maldives, Nigeria, Syria, Uzbekistan, Egypt, Vietnam, Turkmenistan, Laos, Jordan, Tajikistan, Malaysia, Myanmar, Nepal, Brunei, Qatar, Kazakhstan, Ethiopia, Tunisia, Turkey, Kenya, Bhutan, Kuwait, Central African Republic, Palestinian territories, Mali, Indonesia, Mexico, the United Arab Emirates, Bangladesh, Algeria, China, Sri Lanka, Azerbaijan, Oman, Mauritania, Bahrain, Colombia, Djibouti. Not all places that are pointless on a quiz program, but the 50 nations of the world, from number 1 to number 50, where Christians are most likely to experience persecution today. No, India at number 11. The other evening, the Prime Minister of India held a rally at Westminster Central Hall. He is an ultra-nationalistic Hindu who has let it be known that anybody who destroys churches or murders Christians will not be punished in India today. The world in which we live. And having just been on my 24-hour seminar with Open Doors, obviously I came to this passage in a slightly different way than I might have done otherwise, because here is a nation of people who are being oppressed and exploited. And no doubt Moses was encouraged by the response he had had from the leaders of the Israelites when they'd seen the miracles, the signs, and they'd said, "Gosh, God is with you. We trust you as you go to see the Pharaoh." And perhaps he thought that Pharaoh might say, "Yes, I'll let them go to celebrate a festival in the wilderness." But it was not to be so. And Pharaoh responds to Moses with an absolute disdain. He's got no knowledge of Moses' God. Why should he think that he should regard him as having any sense of authority over him? As far as the Egyptian king is concerned, his own divine status means that he has unlimited power. His pronouncements come with divine authority, and his law cannot be challenged by others. In other words, from the Egyptian point of view, it's Moses who is the heretic and blasphemer in the presence of God, who is Pharaoh. Pharaoh's God. So by suggesting that there is another Lord who is higher, he is offending the God who rules over Egypt. Believing himself to be the incarnation of a God, Pharaoh considers himself superior to the Lord. And in the contest that follows, and I think we can call it a contest, Pharaoh's actions pit him squarely against Israel's God. Pharaoh is an anti-God figure, a fact that we've already seen in Exodus. Although it's not this same Pharaoh, because the one in chapters 1 and 2 we're told has died, as somebody has said, every offence committed by the first of the two, the paranoia, the oppressive labour, the lack of wisdom and true success, the killing of babies, adds to the deficit of the second, since he continued in the same mode. In other words, one Pharaoh has just continued from the other Pharaoh. And Pharaoh's antagonism towards the Israelites is underscored by the severity of his response to the modest request that Moses makes. We think of structures like the great temples and the pyramids and the Sphinx, which are all made of stone, which have been carved and placed in put in place, but most of the building in Egypt, the palaces, the houses of the people, the barracks where the army were, the stables where their horses were, vast building works were all brick built. And those bricks were made using clay and straw. The straw bound the clay together and gave the bricks a consistency and a solidity when they dried. And if you go to places like the Fields Museum in Chicago, you can actually see bricks, and you can see the straw in the bricks from Egypt. And Pharaoh is basically saying, you do the same job, but without one of the essential ingredients. At first he says, look, we're just not going to supply it for you. You've got to go and pick it for yourselves. And no doubt that would have meant all the women and children and older people having to go out to fields to pick stubble while the men were at work making bricks and building. Then Pharaoh got to the point of saying, you know what? Just don't use straw. That'll be a challenge. Just build your bricks. Make your bricks. Now, which when you think about it, was a silly thing, because one suspects that it had an effect on the quality of building as well. But that's what happened. And in standing against God, Pharaoh typifies those forces within creation that exalt themselves against God, often ascribing to themselves the authority that alone belongs to the Creator. In resisting God, they also oppress those who desire to worship God. Number one on that list that I read is North Korea, the most dangerous place to be a Christian today, where to have a Bible is to be guilty of an imprisonable offence, with the maximum sentence being a life's hard labour. And sometimes it can be worse. And North Korea is based on, the system there is based on Confucianism. And the philosophy of Confucianism is that the son honours and obeys the father. The father honours and obeys the tribal leader. The tribal leader honours and obeys the community leader. And the community leader honours and obeys the emperor. And what you have in North Korea is a situation where the Kims, three of them now, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and Kim Jong-un, have each placed themselves in that position of emperor. And especially, Kim Jong-il consolidated the idea that this was a divine position, the ultimate leader, to whom all honour should be done. Therefore, there can be no Christianity and no other faith, because he is the one who is worthy alone of praise and adoration in his position. And if you go into any North Korean home, you will find three framed photographs. One of Kim Il-sung, one of Kim Jong-il, and now one of Kim Jong-un. And these are put in a sort of shrine. And every day, each member of the family must gather together, and each member of the family must kneel before these pictures to honour the leader. One day, not so long ago, a small child, 5-year-old, was helping their mother with the household chores and thought he would help by dusting one of these pictures. But unfortunately, in the dusting, he dropped it. The frame smashed. Within just a couple of hours, that child was taken away for re-education, for having failed to understand how important that leader was, and is likely to stay in that education program until well into middle age. Well, there was the family that experienced a fire, and the father, as he got up out of bed and saw the fire coming up the stairs, his first thing was to run downstairs to gather the 3 pictures and to get them out of the house safely, leaving his 3 children to die in the fire. And he was celebrated as a local hero because he had got his priorities right in serving his Lord and his ruler. If we think the story of Exodus is an ancient, ancient story locked up thousands of years ago, the human nature it displays is human nature that we can see in the world today. Both the human nature of the Pharaoh and the human nature of the Israelites, who were frankly pretty fed up. And to have their hopes raised that God was going to do something wonderful and then for it not to happen. What was it all about? With good reason, believers are exhorted in the New Testament to equip themselves in order to stand against the powers of evil. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. Therefore, put on the full armor of God, so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand. Stand firm then, with the belt of truth buckled round your waist, with the breastplate of righteousness in place, and with your feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith, with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Years of exploitation had taken their toll on the Israelites. The oppression of the Egyptians was great. And now things seem to have moved them, since Moses came on the scene again, they seem to have moved out of the frying pan and into the fire. Things have not got better for all the promises that God was about to do something, but they seem to them to have got worse. And although they've cried out for deliverance, they soon turn against Moses when Pharaoh imposes greater hardship on them. And while they might have initially welcomed Moses as their deliverer, now they attack him. Human suffering often undermines confidence in others. Somebody said, faith is often diminished by hardship because emotions play a powerful part in most human thinking, and thinking can become increasingly pessimistic when any sort of pain continues unabated. Very deliberately, Pharaoh drives a wedge between Moses and the Israelite foreman. But as another commentator observes, the foreman have it backward. This Moses, whom they treat so disrespectfully now, is not the reason for their oppression, but God's instrument to end that oppression. If only they could have seen the future, they would have realized that while they were now struggling to build with straw and mud in Egypt, they will later work with gold and silver and bronze to construct a divine dwelling at Mount Sinai. And although their present experience seems to them hopeless, there's an unexpected change of circumstances awaiting the Israelites through God's redeeming and transforming power. One of our speakers at the conference was a man called Ron Boyd McMillan. He is a man who actually works out each year the World Watch list of most persecuted churches. And he was telling us how some years ago he was somewhere and he met a man called Father Gleb Lakunin. And Father Gleb Lakunin had been in a gulag in Siberia for 5 years. He had discovered an injustice, a corruption that was going on between part of the senior hierarchy of the church he served and other local groups, shall we say. And he went to the legal authorities about it. He was the one who was sent to the gulag. Now, that particular gulag camp, hardly anybody ever came back from. To last 5 years was a miracle. And Ron asked him, how did you survive? He said, did you have books? No. Did you have writing materials? No. You had a Bible? No. You had to accompany other people? No, I was in solitary confinement for 5 years. He said, how did you survive? And Father Gleb Lakunin said, I was thankful. And Ron had read enough and spoken to enough people to say, but no one is thankful in the gulag. And he said, I know that. I realized that. And therefore, when I was asked what one thing I would like to take with me would be, I asked for my prayer beads. And he had a string of prayer beads, 3 big beads and 11 beads between each one. And he said to Ron, he said, let me tell you what I did. He said, the first 11 beads, every day, I would start by looking up to the Father and giving him thanks for 11 reasons I was glad to be alive. And then I would give a prayer of thanksgiving to the Father with the big bead. And he said, then I would start on the next 11 beads and I would remember 11 reasons why I was glad to honour Jesus as Lord. And then I would honour Jesus with the next big bead. And then I would go through 11 challenges I had to put in the hands of God because I couldn't do anything about them myself. And then on that last of those 3 big beads, he said, I called on the Holy Spirit to meet those challenges. He said, I did that every day for 5 years. And he said, I came out. He said, what was left me in the cell was to get to know Christ. And perhaps sometimes when we feel that we're trying to get on with this Christian business and all we've got is straw and mud, and sometimes we've not even got the straw, goes a bit against the grain of our Protestant evangelical thinking to get a set of prayer beads. But just since Wednesday when I have heard this, I've started to do this. I just have put it in my journal, 1 to 11, 1 to 11, 1 to 11, and just go through. And I am amazed at the difference it's beginning to make already in me as I just think of 11 things that are reasons I'm glad to be alive, and 11 things for which I'm grateful I can honour Jesus, and 11 challenges to which I can't see an answer myself, but I can give to the Lord. I commend you to try the experiment along with me. So here we have this passage, which doesn't look at this stage as if things are going to go particularly well. But fortunately, it's not an Agatha Christie. We've read the end of the story, and it's quite all right to give one another the spoiler. God wins this one, which is the end of the whole big story. Let's give praise to God. I want to just run a video of a praise song by a young group of Christians called City Light, and then we're going to pray, sing a final song, and close. Thank you.